The study of economics is often referred to as the miserable science. But when you combine real-world expertise and success with a theory of the new capitalism, it makes for a great read. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton talks with an award-winning author and economic theorist about what's new in this new capitalism. That conversation starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. We're trying to get a more contextual, nuanced take on, well, the state of how things just are. A bird's eye view of this second renaissance that's giving us a lot of stuff, from new technologies to some major disruption. And how do these phenomena ripple through the economy? Our next guest is living a double life of economic theorist and practitioner. And those aren't my words. Our guest picked up the moniker from the legendary economist Hyman Minsky 25 years ago.
Here's the irony, the central irony of where we are. The digital revolution was sponsored in every particular, in every one of its components, by the mission-driven American state.
If past is prologue, then our author is helping explain how the digital revolution has grown and taken on a life of its own, and letting us know what comes next. This is William Janeway. He's partner and senior advisor at Warburg Pincus, and we open with him answering my question of how the internet is now the third leg on the stool when it comes to the basis of the economy.
It's an economy of scale. It's network effects.
Network effects. Okay.
Plus something new this time round. And this is where financial speculation, and of course, wherever assets are traded, wherever there are markets and assets, there will be bubbles. Mostly those bubbles will be focused on tulip bulbs, ranch houses in the Nevada desert,
right?
Perhaps one might say virtual cryptocurrencies with no underlying fundamental value. But occasionally they have been focused on those transformational technologies teed up by prior state investments like railroads and electricity, as well as the internet. Now, today with the internet, there's something new. A new source, a new kind of positive feedback, such that the leaders, the winners, become even more powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's the value derived from capturing the incredibly rapidly increasing volumes of data mm-hmm. that are both uniquely generated but also captured by all transactions on the internet.
Let me ask real quick. Do you find that the accumulation of that data leads to a concentration of power that can possibly lead to a suffocation of competition in the market?
That is very much what I'm saying. And I'm pleased to say there is very powerful, compelling economic research from MIT, David Autor, to Stanford, Nick Bloom, triangulated with the work of the outstanding research staff at the OECD in Paris, the kind of consortium that the U.S. originally sponsored after World War II of the developed nation, that suggests that in industry after industry, there's greater degrees of concentration, much greater degrees of concentration, and that the winners, the superstar firms, are so much more profitable that you can actually see their footprint in the aggregate data, the aggregate statistics on income inequality. This is a profound shift in the structure of our economy. And of course, it goes with the other aspects of what the digital revolution has generated, beginning with globalization, the elimination of friction in international trade and production, mm-hmm. in global production networks, as well as with the transformation of the context in which the political process takes place. We're living in a new world, and this is what really motivated to go back into what I'd been working on and extend and revise it, because here's the irony, the central irony of where we are. The digital revolution was sponsored in every particular, in every one of its components, by the mission-driven American state, driven by the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. ARPANET and so forth.
Exactly right. DARPA, mm-hmm. Defense Department. By the 80s and into the 90s, it had begun to take off. And even after the extraordinary acceleration generated by the great internet bubble of the late 1990s, the digital revolution has taken off under its own momentum, and not only does it no longer need the sponsorship of government, it's actually attacking the authority of government at virtually every level, from trying to deal with the consequences of globalization and automation, the transformation of the labor market, to the micro disruptions generated by such companies as Uber and Airbnb.
Okay.
And of course, as we all know from the Facebook issues and the discussion of the 2016 election, it's actually serving to undermine the integrity of the political process itself.
Okay, you've brought me back to a follow-up question on something you said towards the beginning about cryptocurrencies. Don't you find those fascinating? Because I see them almost as a chaos proxy.
Well, I think that's right. And I think what they reflect is the flip side of that irony. That is, here you have the state, the American government, which was the only begetter of the digital revolution. And now you have government discredited as an economic actor, rendered illegitimate, limited in any capacity for buffering and responding to the drive of globalization and automation. And consequently, you have this kind of peculiar challenge to the authority of the state as the source of money and the underwriting of the financial system, which it saved from self-destruction only 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Now, the further irony of the Bitcoin, blockchain, crypto phenomenon is this. The place where the underlying infrastructure is most likely to find use cases, applications that give it long life are actually not in supporting initial coin offerings, which I think of as scam squared. First, you buy a currency in order to buy a token, which will give you access to something you'll be told about in the indefinite future.
Yeah.
But it is actually between, it's the exact opposite of what Bitcoin was invented for. Very large, regulated, established players known to each other because they're banks like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan may find ways of using the type of infrastructure. And by the way, the Bitcoin blockchain is a terrible vehicle. It's just very limited in its performance. Mm. But there may be approaches that will work out as to how to use this new kind of infrastructure to render interaction transactions between major players who know each other and who are regulated, how to do that in a more efficient way.
Okay.
But that would be, in a way, the ultimate irony for Bitcoin,
right,
in the heart of the system rather than a kind of rebel alliance,
right,
operating outside.
Right. Go from anarchy to regulatory.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Mr. Janeway, let's go back to, and I could talk to you all day. I could definitely get in the weeds with you because I like to get lost, but I want to pull you back out just for a second. Doing capitalism in the innovation economy, the title of your book. A lot of people, when they hear innovation economy, they immediately think of venture capital, but you're going a little bit beyond that, right?
Well, yes, but a substantial part of the book explains how, in some detail, I learned how the innovation economy works by being in the trenches as a working venture capitalist. I came out of Cambridge University with a doctorate in economics and had been taught by the students of the great John Maynard Keynes, and taught in the classroom lessons that I discovered as a venture capitalist were profoundly relevant.
Mm.
Those lessons included the fact that we all live under conditions of radical uncertainty about the future consequences of the decisions we make today. I learned that money is not a veil, as it was propagated by the Chicago neoclassical economist, but it's an asset. It's money, cash is an asset that we can hold in order to insure ourselves against an unknowable future, against bad things happening. And that I discovered in the actual world of building new companies from scratch at the frontier of technology was profoundly, profoundly relevant. So there's a kind of conversation between my own life as a venture capitalist and then discovering that, like every other venture capitalist, I've been dancing on a platform, on a stage that had been constructed by the Department of Defense, and the rewards from which were a function of attracting the speculative spirits of the stock market to the promise that what we were up to could actually create a new economy. Now, of course, in 1998, 99, 2000, they got a little bit ahead of themselves, those speculators. I was had the enormous good fortune of having done my doctoral dissertation on 1929 to 31. So I'd seen that movie before,
right,
at my firm, Warburg Pincus, where we were deeply invested in helping to build the infrastructure for turning the internet from a medium for information and communication into an environment for commerce. We liquidated our portfolio into the bubble. Of course, in 2007-8, having worked on 1931 as well, I'm delighted to say I'd seen that movie before, too. But it was the process of working as a venture capitalist that revealed this structural institutional framework, the context, the institutions, which over not just the digital revolution, but going all the way back, to when DeWitt Clinton mobilized the credit of the state of New York to finance the Erie Canal in the 1810s. And of course, the enormous land grants to subsidize the promoters who built the transcontinental railroads around the time of the Civil War. There's a long history here of the state backing entrepreneurs, providing them with support, and at a certain point, the new technologies getting close enough to commercial realization for the stock market to pile back in. And the railroads were funded by massive speculation in London and New York over the course of 50 years, not unlike the speculation that laid the fiber cable in the ground, which only began to be fully utilized 10, 15 years later after the companies that had actually put it in the ground had gone bankrupt, just the way the railways went bankrupt
right
in the 1880s.
But
as I say, this, I discovered this long history, and this is where frustration comes in. Because we look forward. As I say, the digital revolution's on its own. It is appealing. It is forcing reconsideration of regulatory frameworks from the
right,
the city level, as everybody in San Francisco knows, up to the national and the international level. But there's another revolution out there from which the United States seems, at least for the time being, not the state of California, but seems to have abdicated itself from. And that, of course, is the Green Revolution.
Right.
And where, having dropped out of the Paris Accord, having unfunded the kind of basic research that led to semiconductors and software, we are standing aside and have, in effect, granted a free pass for China to become the leader of the next transformational technological revolution.
Yeah, you know, we're recording this just a day after Bill Gates saying that we are in perilous waters when it comes to being the world leader in so many ways. But I want to go back. Okay, you mentioned land grants going to railroads. The parallel track, if you will, and I will use that. The other land grants that were used were for higher learning institutions that kind of funded into the economy. So what I'm hearing you say is that this disruptive technology that is the internet being used for commerce and new scale and network effects has not had a parallel track to help us prepare for that, right?
I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, it was the same administration, Abraham Lincoln's administration, that passed the Pacific Railway Act and passed the Morrill Act that created the land-grant universities. And here's something we've lost. The notion of higher education as a public good, as an investment that as a society we should make, because the benefits, the returns from that investment were going to be spread across the entire population.
Exactly.
We've lost that. You know, and I hate to say it, but in a way, California was a little bit out in front here with Prop 13. It's wonderful to have seen University of California get new funding and a statewide acceptance of responsibility. But there's hardly a state university in the country that receives as much as 10% of its budget from the legislature. They're increasingly, in effect, they've been privatized by stealth. And that is a great loss.
Macro question, last question for you, Professor Janeway. Are we prepared at present to deal with the monopoly situation? Are we in a monopoly situation? Are we headed towards one? And do we have the laws to deal with it?
Clearly, there are some laws on the books which, if enforced, would deal with some aspects of the consequences of the digital revolution. But this is a place in considering the kind of regulatory reform that will be responsible to this new economy. Europe is actually way in front of us. Now, on the one hand, a kind of conventional, old-fashioned antitrust response was the European Commission fining Google for favoring its own offerings versus others. That you could find the basis for that in the Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914.
Okay.
But the area which I think is most sensitive and most important is what's happened to the labor market. I saw this morning that there's just been a ruling with respect to who counts as a full-time employee, ruling in California, who counts as a full-time employee and who is a fully independent contractor. We've clearly created an intermediate space between those two historic categories. I think it would take, but we've done this before, the kind of imaginative collaboration between public and private sectors to work out how there can be a structure of regulation that's relevant for the gig economy. I do have to say, however, for that to work, health care insurance, pensions must be decoupled from employment. And in an economy, an innovative economy driven by entrepreneurship, the notion that you can't afford to leave your job for something new and exciting because your children are at risk of not being able to get medical care, or your parents are at risk of the nursing home without support, is appalling. So building out a much deeper and broader social safety net, not private sector safety net, but social safety net, is critical aspect of taking advantage of the new digital economy.
Would one leg on that stool be universal basic income?
You know, I think that's worth arguing about. I know people whom I respect on both sides of that discussion.
Me too.
I do think that one leg of that, however, would be Medicare for everybody.
I'm with you on that. Professor Janeway, thank you for your work, and thank you for this book, Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, and thank you for your time this morning.
Delighted. Wonderful discussion.
That's Bill Janeway. Bill has a new edition of his book out. It's called Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, Reconfiguring the Three-Player Game Between Markets, Speculators, and the State. Now, given Mr. Janeway's 40 years as a tech and growth investor at Warburg Pincus, you could say he's an expert in the age we're enduring right now. For links to Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, head to kgoradio.com and look for this week's show notes article. All of our podcasts and shows are there as well. You can also find and share them on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you graze for your podcasts. Just keyword search Techonomics. And that's it for this week's show. Check us online at facebook.com/techonomicsradio. We post links to the music beds. And we're at kgoradio.com/techonomics. And you can follow me on Twitter if you like. I'm at KGO Jason. For producer Liana Wilcox and executive producer Mike Anthony, I'm the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. Thanks again for listening, and have great weeks, everybody.